Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
Welcome to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and part of the Christians for Liberty Network. I am your host, Doug Stewart, and I have special guests with us today, Dominic Scarsella, who is the author of a brand new book, Good Neighbor, Bad Citizen, Reflections on the Core Social Conflict Revealed by Jesus Christ's Way of the Cross. He also writes on his Substack with the same name as this book title, Good Neighbor, Bad Citizen. Dom, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Doug. Great to be here.
So your book is very timely. This episode will drop basically a week before Good Friday, if I'm not mistaken, based on my schedule right now. And so for those who are listening, you're going to get a nice little Easter, timely Easter treat. And this is Passion Week coming up. And what I think is really important, Dom, for our audience to know is where exactly are you coming from as a Christian, as a believer? And then we'll get into the politics piece as we discuss. But tell us a little bit about yourself.
If you remember the story of Jesus talking about the workers who went out to work in the fields at 6 a.m. and then another batch of workers went out to work at 9 a.m. and then at noon, all the way up to people who were hired just a few minutes before the end of the workday. I was nominally Christian since birth, but I didn't really start get to work until I was in my teen years. So I was maybe hired at 6, but slacked off until maybe 9 or 10. So my own personal faith is taking it more seriously as I sort of entered adulthood. It's been a journey. It's been a lot of reflection and a lot of prayer and a lot of practicing my faith. And I tend to tell people that I'm really an early churcher. That doesn't mean I get up really early and go to the first mass on Sunday morning. It means I'm really interested in the early church, the pre-Constantine church, the church that was not politically powerful, was not imposing on other people, had in fact was quite on the opposite end of that power dynamic. Because you can see, I think there's a more genuine and a more honest faith there. And thank goodness that we have the New Testament writings that go back that far and can give us a glimpse into a kind of Christianity that we probably don't see as often in popular culture, especially growing out of the European Christendom era and sort of that making its way across the Atlantic Ocean to the Americas. So I'm very much steeped in the Gospels. I read everything in the Bible in light of the Gospels. So if the Old Testament is in conflict with the Gospels, then I know that's something that Jesus was correcting in his public ministry. And it quite often is that way explicitly. So I'm very much steeped in the Bible as God's gradual revelation in human history that culminates with Jesus. So the fullness of revelation is there in the Gospels. And then I color everything based on that. The Gospels are my palette by which I explore everything else, not only in Christian scripture, but in Christian tradition, all the way up to the present day where we try to embody the things that we say we believe.
You said something early on as you were describing what you like to do in your Christian walk, and I forget the exact words, but you said, but you used the word practice. And I think that your book here, Good Neighbor, Bad Citizen, actually lends itself well to a reader who wants to have something pretty accessible to practice and to consider. Would you say, if I described it as somewhat devotional, would you agree with that assessment? How would you feel about that?
I agree, and thank you for noticing that about it and having that kind of impression of it. It's a very short book, maybe 64 pages as a printed paperback. It is under 10,000 words. The body of the book, the introduction, the five chapters, and the closing prayer. So this can be read by your average adult in under an hour. Now, if you'd like to take longer and use it as a meditative aid, you can. It still won't be much more than an hour or so, but it's set up where it can be used as a devotional. I know there are many denominations of Christianity that still keep the Stations of the Cross as a devotional, especially during the time leading up to Passion Week into the Paschal season as well, or just for year round. At this point, it's this kind of thing that we can pray anytime we want, even if there's not a special season set aside to emphasize it. But yes, it goes through the 14 traditional stations of the cross. And I do that because I think the traditional stations of the cross are a wonderful way to not only break down Jesus's persecution, his ordeal, into smaller pieces that can be meditated more deeply on, but it also fills in the blanks that our gospels don't tell us about, because the original audience for the gospels would have known it all. Like, you don't have to tell people back then what a crucifixion is. You don't have to tell them what a scourging is. You don't have to tell them what it means to carry your cross on the way to a crucifixion. They know all this. So the gospels are very, very brief in just mentioning this thing. You know, when Jesus is crucified, all they say is they crucified him. That's it. No other details, because nobody back then needed to be told what that meant. But we, an ocean and a half away, almost 2,000 years, how many different languages away, it's a very different culture. I think these very, very early devotions of the early church, like the Stations of the Cross, they hold a lot of richness for people in 2024 over in the Americas, speaking English or whatever it is we speak that's not Aramaic and Greek and Old Latin.
Early on in your book, I have it listed here as on page 5 because I bought the print book. What? You have this sentence that I think in some ways is a nice hook for my audience.
Okay.
Quote, being a good neighbor requires a different mindset and value system than being a good citizen. I think that's a very attractive statement to somebody who's a libertarian. Okay. And hopefully anybody who's a Christian. Okay. Unfortunately, it's not the case. A lot of times being a good neighbor and being a good citizen are wrapped into one sort of unit for a lot of Christians. Would you agree? And why do you think that's the case?
There's been 1,700 years of that nonsense since the time of Constantine.
I could have predicted that response, and I wasn't leading you, but I'm chuckling just because I'm like, well, duh, of course that's actually what one of the explanations for it.
Sure. And in fact, I take that to task in the very first chapter in Station 2, which is Jesus taking his cross. And I mentioned that, you know, as Christianity during and after the reign of the Roman Emperor Constantine, which is early 4th century AD, becomes politically acceptable, the notion of carrying one's cross becomes distorted. After all, so-called Christians now occupy prominent positions within the hierarchical social order. So-called Christians share in the exercise of coercive civil authority. So-called Christians can violently impose the cross on others. What great progress for so-called Christian citizenship. What great loss for true Christian neighborliness. So I think the breaking point there is Constantine and the fact that there were so many people within the church hierarchy who were ready to jump on board and become cronies, become imperial cronies, and really let some of that paganism into the church. And it's been 1,700 years of trying to fight that, from trying to find out where is that gospel message still alive, and how do we have to fight the people who just want to take it backwards into what Jesus was trying to correct people from during his public ministry.
How is it, do you recommend that we fight that? I mean, I hear you say we need to fight the people that are trying to take that power. And I'm thinking, well, I don't want to fight the people. I want to fight those ideas.
Yes. I'm a big logic guy. So ad hominem is a logical fallacy. Appeal to authority is a logical fallacy. So in strict logic language, yeah, don't go after the person, go after the idea that's wrong or the action or the behavior that's wrong. In Christian circles, we say that a little differently. We say something like, hate the sin, love the sinner. So yes, as you were saying, target the thing that's actually wrong, which is not necessarily the human being, but the action, the attitude, the way the will is being directed, the activity and behavior. Go after that stuff. I am a big fan of undermining, not overthrowing. Because Jesus is an underminer. Jesus is an underminer of these social structures, of this, these social status and these hierarchical imposed social orders. I've heard some people refer to it as Irish democracy. Simply don't comply with the things that are wrong and go about doing your business. That's why the book is called Good Neighbor, Bad Citizen, and not just Bad Citizen, because it's not simply about being a thorn in the side of the imposed social order, the government as we call it. It's about first learning what it means to exist positively in the world, in a society with other human beings, and how to treat them. So the Jesus model is good neighbor first, and it's the good neighbor part that makes him a bad citizen because of what citizen means. And as much as Christians for the last 1700 years have tried to conflate neighbor and citizen and church and the imposed hierarchical social order, even if you don't want to call it state or government, but as much as Christians have tried to conflate that, oh, the Gospels disagree.
Why do you think many Christians and even theologians have tried to make, I would call it, make excuses for a dual allegiance or a dual honoring of both church and state and sort of try to hold them separately? I don't think the people who would sort of advocate for maybe a God and country mentality or a sort of social justice imposition from on high sort of mentality, which we could see on both the left and the far, both the far left and the far right. Mm-hmm. I don't think they would attest to this started back in Constantine and it was a good idea. They would just be like, well, this is just in the scriptures, or this is just a way that we read the scriptures, and this is how it's okay, and this is how it's not in conflict. But, you know, and what you're saying, and I would agree, of course, is that this good neighbor, bad citizen comes together. You can't be both. And it's sort of, they're at odds with one another. And so why is it that you think people want to justify that beyond the explanation of Constantine?
And that's a good point, because there may be people nowadays who have no idea that this started with Constantine. They don't know the history. They just know what they see in their present day.
Well, 15 years ago, I didn't.
Yeah, me neither. I mean, Jesus made me an anarchist, which was wonderful. Like the more I got into my faith, the more I started questioning the other things I saw. So for me, it was a deep dive into the Gospels that did it for me. But I wonder if the difficulty that other people are having is maybe the difficulty I had a long time ago, which is, for one thing, we don't seek out conflict, and we like to think that our ideas are the majority ideas. So if I believe in Jesus, and I believe in, say, the old creeds and the tenets of the old creeds, and I believe in the soul, I believe in salvation and redemption, I believe that there's a God who is beyond just our temporal, physical, material lives. I believe there's a part of us that survives the death, quote unquote, the death of our temporal lives. So I believe all that, and I want to think that the other institutions I see around me, especially the popular ones, are mostly aligned with the good things that I already believe. So I think it's from my own anecdotal evidence that I seem to observe elsewhere, it's a basic human desire to be liked and to think that the things that I like can be liked by other people. So why would I not want Hollywood and the news media to be Christian as well? Why would I not want the government to be Christian? And if you're approaching it from that standpoint, I think it's easy to cherry pick elements and say, oh yes, of course the government is Christian, because the government keeps law and order, and I like order, and law is good, and because there are things you should do and things you shouldn't do. And so this all seems vaguely Christian to me. So there's that overlap there. I think it's a desire for people to want that.
In your book, you talk about three key examples of Jesus being in confrontation between loyalties, that is, being a neighbor and being a citizen. And actually, two of them, I think most of my audience actually is familiar with all three, but not in the way that you're framing it. One is the temptation of Jesus. The other is the role of the disciples, where they're asking him to have high status. And then the Good Samaritan. Mm-hmm. And the one with the Good Samaritan kind of caught me off guard a little bit, as in, like, this was not an insight that I would have noticed. Now, if you want to go through the other two, that's fine. Would you like to share a little bit about why are those examples of Jesus confronting loyalties? That was the word that you used.
Sure, that's in the introduction. I used all three of those to kind of set up some of the backstory for Jesus, because of course the way of the cross is just the very, very end of his public ministry and really the end of his temporal life. But there's a lot of the gospels that goes into it. So the Good Samaritan to me is a wonderful example of these competing loyalties of neighbor and citizen. And I won't recite the gospel passage. I'm sure your listeners are familiar enough with it. If they want to go looking for it, it's handy. It's the Gospel of Luke chapter 10, verses 29 to 37 is what I cite.
Yeah.
And of course, as the story goes, there's a man on a rather treacherous road outside of Jerusalem, and he gets overcome by robbers. They beat him, they leave him half to death. A priest wanders by on the road and sees him and passes by on the opposite side without approaching him. A Levite passes by this fallen man and again passes by without approaching him. And then a Samaritan, who is from a tribe or so that's sort of looked down upon for Jesus's immediate audience, he sees the victim and goes over and ministers to him. And I write that it may be tempting to dismiss the priest and the Levite as thoughtless individuals with no sense of responsibility to their fellow humans, but this view shortchanges their situations. Priests and Levites occupied positions of status within the social order. So right away, I'm drawing that there's a little bit of citizenship maybe at work here. In accordance with their privileged offices, they were forbidden to touch or get too close to dead bodies. And I refer people to Leviticus 21 and Numbers 19 for more information on that. To approach the half-dead victim of the robbers would risk ceding their hierarchical duties, at least until they could complete a purification period. Knowing this, they each pass by on the opposite side. Within this context, they aren't being thoughtless. It's simply that their most pressing thoughts are to their occupations in society. They aren't devoid of regard for their fellow humans. It's simply that their heaviest social responsibility they feel is to the hierarchical order. They're being good citizens. They're also clearly not the heroes of the parable. So yes, was that some of the digging into it, remembering?
Yeah, the heavy social responsibility to the hierarchical order. It was almost like reading your description of this and your reflection on it as noticing something that we often just sort of brush off as in like, well, that's not the punchline of the story, right? Like they're just the foil to show that the despisable Samaritan was actually the hero of the story. And there's actually something to be noticed in them. And in some ways, yes, you could say, you know, you're assuming in a way, maybe not positive intent, but you're assuming the best of them in the sense that, well, they're not just evil individuals who are careless.
I've tried to steel man their position. You've heard of
straw manning. Yeah, that would be one way of doing it. Yeah.
I've heard of the term steel manning. I was trying to steel man. This book for me is an exercise in cognitive empathy, which I've been really trying to get into for the past several years, which is being able to see things from another person's perspective rather than projecting what I want onto the other person and pretending that they feel it too or that they experience it the way I do. This is an exercise in cognitive empathy here. Like, okay, so from a priest standpoint, what do all of these details mean? From a Levite standpoint, what do these details mean? And could you see how those influences might influence their behavior, pressure their behavior in a particular way? So yeah, I do a lot of that in this book as well, of taking Bible passages that you may have heard before and maybe digging into them in a way that you haven't heard of them before. And I hope that's where some of maybe the devotional quality of the book comes in, that you had mentioned earlier, that, yeah, you can meditate on this book and I hope not get bored, at least not the first time you read it.
One thing that I've been working on more recently, and maybe you and I are very similar in this respect, is finding the priority to spend more time and less rush and less hurry on a particular passage of scripture and to notice the kinds of things that are going on in it. And in some cases that happens in group settings for me, but it has been a tremendously fruitful exercise to not just keep rushing on and to reflect on things. And the other danger is to be hyper-devotional in the sense that, like, well, I'm just going to read one verse and ignore what's all around it. But the other piece of it is you're not actually really meditating on that. You're really just sort of figuring out what to get out of it, which in one sense is okay. But on the other, what you're doing is, as a good example, you're doing an exercise in meditating on the particular passages that are through the Stations of the Cross, the passage through the Station of the Cross, mm-hmm. but you're not just like isolating this one little piece and hyper-devotionalizing it. So I appreciate that for sure. Early on, as you're sort of introducing, as you get to the Stations of the Cross, you talk about how you want this to be a prayerful reflection on the core conflict mm-hmm. revealed by Jesus's passion and death. Can you talk a little bit about that core conflict? And if you want, you can go into these stations as, not everyone obviously, but like, you talk about 14 stations of the cross, and then there's a bonus, but yep. what is this core conflict revealed by Jesus's passion and death?
The core conflict is about your loyalties and about your worldview and where you get your direction and your guidance for your actions. I go into it very early in the introduction where I just set up a bunch of contrasts. Good neighbors treat each other as peers. Good citizens treat each other according to official status. Good neighbors seek the personal, intimate betterment of themselves and each other. Good citizens seek the external validation of an impersonal system. Good neighbors align to voluntary, open-ended interactions. That's where we're getting really into the kind of language that maybe libertarians and voluntarists would understand. Good citizens align to coercive civil authority and imposed hierarchical social order. Good neighbors insource their ethics, and this may be the biggest thing of all. Good neighbors insource their ethics. Charity and friendship are the key virtues of their relationships. Good citizens outsource their ethics. Compliance with the commands of rulers and enforcers is a fundamental and necessary aspect. Some might call it a civic virtue. Good neighbors consent. Good citizens conform. And I draw that distinction not simply to draw a contrast between good neighbor and good citizen, but also to perhaps make us reflect on our churches. How much of our churches veered toward compliance? Don't understand what you're doing, just do what you're told.
Mm.
So I think there's a self-awareness and a self-reflection that has to go on for us as Christians. That do we really embrace what it means to be good neighbor, to be on equal footing with other people, to be peers with them, rather than to externalize our constantly seeking for external validation? Or do we insource our ethics, which is what it means to develop your conscience? Or do we outsource our ethics, where we're just looking for that leader to tell us what to do? And a good gospel lesson about that is just seeing how often Jesus tries not to be known as the Messiah. Like when people figure out that he's the anointed one, he tells them, can you please not tell other people about that? Because I don't want people flocking to me and just going, oh, he's the new leader who's going to order us around. Jesus doesn't want to encounter people that way. He wants to encounter people where they are at their level, not as a person who's going to violently impose on them or who will threaten them with something if they don't do what he says. Jesus wants to meet people as a peer. Jesus is trying so hard as God, who would have every right to be hierarchically imposing on us. He's trying so much to be the good neighbor to us, to give us an example of that, but also to teach us that good neighborliness is the key to living your faith. It's not getting yourself in charge of an institution and making everybody do what you want because you won the election, or you drew the long straw instead of the short straw, or you were just born into it for your name in some dynastic continuation. No, there's a neighborliness and a difference that is, and frankly, like you said, if you really want to get into it, the way of the cross gives you such a contrast between people who are trying to do what they're told, and there's Jesus, who's trying to undermine that and still even love the people who are awful to him.
Mm.
And I don't know that there's a particular thing I can point to in the way of the cross, because like you brought up, I like to read the Bible in context. So not only with the verses that are around it, so I don't do the cherry picking of a verse and just focus on that.
Yeah.
I can't stand those Bible verse a day calendars. They're so shallow to me. And they risk being dull as well. And I'm not a meme guy. I don't like, because memes are so often shallow and they're just something out of context that somebody's just trying to get a cheap punchline for. So I don't like things that are shallow. I prefer things that are deep. And I think the way you described trying to read the Bible is you don't want to be slow, but at the same time, you want to make an effort. And an effort, of course, takes time. So I like to be deeper in my reading of the Gospels than just giving it a surface glance. But I don't want to do like fake devotional where you're just doing it so slowly, but not getting anywhere. Like you're not getting any more depth for your slowness. You're just being slow. You're not finding any more genuine insight. You're just cherry picking something and trying to assign something that you already like to it and using it to rationalize. I don't do that. I hope that the book does lead people and encourage people to take a contextual and a culturally relevant view of the Gospels. And by culturally relevant, I mean understanding the relevance in the culture in which these events happened, not before you get to how are they relevant to my culture. I think people want to go, how is this relevant to me right away?
Yeah, right. Yep.
But first you have to understand what it is you're reading. Understand what you're reading and what's happening here before you make a connection to something that you're more familiar with.
Yeah, that's well said. Is there anything about the book you want to share and that I haven't asked you about that you want our listeners to hear about? And then where should they go to download or purchase it?
You can find the paperback. It's all on demand publishing at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble's website, or at lulu.com, where you can order a paperback and they'll print it up for you and ship it to you right away. It doesn't go through a third party. It doesn't go through a bookstore. It doesn't go through me as the author. I don't have stacks of the books sitting here in my home waiting to be shipped out. It's all on demand publishing if you're like me and you like physical copies. If you're more of an e-reader, Amazon has the book available for their Kindle format, which you can also have Kindle for desktop if you don't use it on mobile devices. Barnes & Noble has it available for their Nook devices. If you'd like to get a good preview of the book before you decide if you want the whole thing, Amazon's Kindle version has a very lengthy preview of it, a free preview before you hit the buy button. It'll take you through most of the introduction, several pages into it, which takes you through the three Bible passages that you had mentioned earlier, Doug, and into crystallizing more of the conflict there. But depending on how you like to read with the physical thing in your hands, turning the pages or reading yourselves, or I've heard even some people tell me that they get the ebook version and have their mobile or tablet app just do text to voice for them. So they make their own audiobook out of it.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool.
Whatever you're into, the book is under 10,000 words. It's not a long read, but it's the kind of read that I hope is deep for people. And it's the kind of thing that I hope people can revisit if they'd like to and can be used for different things. It can be used as your introduction to maybe this aspect of Christianity that you didn't know before. It can be used as your introduction to maybe the seasonal events of Lent and Passion Week, Holy Week, and then the Paschal season. It can be used as a little bit of a dive into the history of the time, or it can be used as a devotional if you want to use these Stations of the Cross and some of these Bible passages and meditations as a jumping off point for yourself exploring these aspects of your faith in even greater detail and with greater effort. It's almost a choose your own adventure for people. It does have a context and there's a realness to it. But I don't want to tell people that there's only one way to read a short devotional. There's only one way to pray the Stations of the Cross. There's only one reason why you should be interested in Jesus's persecution and in a time 2,000 years ago and the history. There's many different reasons why we may be drawn to this. Hopefully we all wind up pointing towards God and towards that holy transcendent and towards the revelation that Christ gives us. But that journey can happen from many different starting points and from many different motivations. And I hope the book is accessible to more people than just hardcore churchgoers or just hardcore anarchists and libertarians who, you know, have been searching for something to say, ha ha, see, Jesus really is on our side. I didn't want it to be tribalist, but, you know, some people may take it that way in one direction or the other. I hope it's something that's genuinely valuable to people. And I love continuing the conversation with all the new people I've met through the blog, like you've said, on Substack, Good Neighbor, Bad Citizen on Substack, and through the book and through these wonderful conversations and the people I'm meeting like you, Doug. This has been wonderful for me. And it's been great talking with you and meeting you and sharing a little bit of our faith in this half hour or so.
Yeah, well, Dominic Scarsella, author of Good Neighbor, Bad Citizen, thank you for joining me for this episode.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you like today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.
Hello, everyone. It's Doug from the Libertarian Christian Podcast. You might notice already that this recording sounds quite a bit different from usual. In fact, it probably sounds pretty crappy. Well, I'm doing this to show you something pretty amazing. As you might know, the guys over at Podsworth Media have been producing my show for several years, quite a while, hundreds of episodes. And now they have a brand new online app for taking rough recordings like this one and making them sound a whole lot cleaner and a lot more listenable in just a few easy clicks. So here are some of the core features. They remove background noise. It reduces plosives, which is really handy for me because I often forget to put my pop filter on before I do a YouTube video. Because pop filters look terrible when you're on camera. It fixes clipping. It removes clicks and pops. It evenly levels dialogue so that you don't have somebody talking really quietly. And then somebody talking really loud because they're too close to the mic or too far away from the mic. How do you use it? It's easy. You go to podsworth.com, you click get started. And because you're a listener to one of the Libertarian Christian Institute's podcasts, you can get 50% off your first order by entering the promo code LCI50. That's LCI50. And you will get 50% off your first order. If you are doing anything like a podcast, a video, a sermon, an audiobook, anything that's spoken word, you want to use podsworth.com and clean up your audio to be even more professional and polished.